Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
As a defender, you could stop a million attacks, you're wrong once, and you're sort of hung, drawn, and quartered for it. You know, and that's not a good position to put people in either. It's a stressful enough job as it is without having that as your ultimate outcome from a mistake.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into the world of application security. Jason Morell is a cybersecurity advocate and consultant with more than two decades of experience in business and entrepreneurship. He spoke about both successes and setbacks he's experienced in the startup world, including as a founding shareholder in Starwood Whiskey and co-founder of Altius Mining. In recent years, Jason's career has focused on cybersecurity, including roles such as the COO of CyberAware and the group executive of OSCyber. We chat about how Jason's business experience has helped shape his approach to cybersecurity, learning from mistakes, financial literacy, and plenty more. So let's jump right in. And we're live. So, hey, Jason, how you going?
Very, very well, Cole. How are you going?
I've had a crazy day. I started at Newcastle Uni giving a lecture about risk. And I know that sounds really boring, but it was pretty fun, actually.
Not to me.
I was talking about the likelihood of getting punched in the face, right? As a way to make it relatable to students.
Yep.
Saying, like, you can wear a motorcycle helmet to, you know, control the risk, or you can never leave the house to avoid the risk.
Yep.
And got a bunch of laughs out of a topic that otherwise is pretty dry.
Well, that is good. Yeah, we've got to make risk interesting. I think that's one of the ones when talking about incident response, I always say is the old, everyone has a plan till they're punched in the face, the old Mike Tyson line. You know, you can run a plan if you want, but it's not until you actually get a real incident that you actually see, you know, how well prepared you are for it. So very similar to Mike Tyson smashing in the face, I'm sure.
Yeah. So that was a good one. And then just had a bunch of coffees with just random people because, you know, that's a business owner. You've got to go out and sell, right? So just meet as many people as possible and see who wants to actually sign. So, and now I'm back here doing a fun podcast with you. So,
well, we'll hopefully get some people signing off the back of this for you.
Yeah, so thanks. So first question I ask almost all my guests is, what kind of bird are you and why?
Okay, bird. Probably my favorite, and it's not a bird, is a great white shark. So I've always had an affinity to those or been interested.
It's a seabird, right? It's a bird that swims in the sea.
A seabird, yeah. Maybe they probably eat seagulls or something like that. So yeah. I think that's a tenuous link I can put to that. But always been fascinated by them. So I've done cage diving with sharks in South Australia off Port Lincoln and everything's just, one of my favorites. But they probably do eat seagulls and other seabirds. So I'll just go with shark. How's that sound?
So, but why great white over like the other ones? Is there just Aussie or?
It was just an affinity I had just from a young age. I think I watched one of the, might have been on ABC or something like that. It was Valerie Taylor, you know, swimming with some great white sharks, and her husband Ron was filming. And from there, I just had an obsession with any documentary that was around great white sharks and obviously misunderstood. I mean, obviously there's, there's occasional death happening from sharks, but, you know, we're in their domain when we're there. So there is some risk, but, you know, more people die from getting kicked by a horse or thrown from a horse or stung by a bee than, you know, great white sharks. But we don't go out and try and eliminate all that, but they're fascinating when you get to know them as a species. So love anything around great whites.
Good lesson in risk management, right?
That's right. Keep out of the water.
Sharks are like, one of the things is I feel in cybersecurity, a lot of the messaging that we do is like, there are sharks in the water, you know, be wary of the sharks in the water. And that's like kind of how we portray adversaries a lot of the time. And so, which I don't think is particularly helpful because it's the same as like us telling people, hey, don't click on links or like watch every email or don't go swim outside the flags or whatever. People are going to do what they're going to do, and just like trying to scare people the whole time means they're not really going to be looking into it all that much. So here we are with our fellow sharks.
That's right. I think, probably a tenuous link to others, but I think you're right. There is a lot of similarity there that, you know, sharks and shark attacks that tend to happen at sunrise or sunset, You know, it is often where they're mistaken for, to say, surface on a board, it looks like a seal from below. There's a lot of things that you can do to mitigate those situations as well, like, you know, checking a link or hovering over it before clicking on it or going to the proper site and all those sorts of things we teach in cybersecurity. Maybe we can make a whole course designed around sharks as attackers. And
we'll call it Cyber Shark Week.
Cyber Shark. Well, someone's probably got it. So I'm sure if we look for it, it's probably registered somewhere. So, yeah, no, it's fascinating. When you sort of look behind it, like anything, as you say, risk can be mitigated by just being logical in most cases. And it's when people aren't being logical or do stupid things, they increase their risk in any facet of life. So, you know, I agree with that.
Yeah, enough about sharks. I know that we could talk about all day about them. What I'd like to hear about is about your story and your career, because I've had a look through your LinkedIn and you've been through a lot of different types of, I'd say, careers and roles and eventually ended up in cybersecurity. But maybe you could outline where you came from and like just tell us about the different parts of your career.
The start of it really was probably more in sort of financial services is where I sort of started. So I did a Diploma of Financial Planning back in the day at Westpac Financial Services. And that was more to understand, you know, obviously finance. There was a personal bit. I think a lot of people do things because they want to learn for themselves before they help others, you know, often. I'm sure a lot of us in cybersecurity are like that. But also, you know, someone who might have had problems with their teeth might tend to be a dentist, you know, so they can help other people or whatever the case is. So I think sometimes you get guided that way. I had done some little businesses beforehand and had been sort of stitched up by some people, let's say, that I'd gone to business with from not understanding numbers and how things worked on that front. So I was refinancing a house and actually the person I was refinancing with said, we're actually looking for financial planners. They'll pay for the course and all that sort of stuff. And that's how that sort of happened from there. But once you're in that sort of in the banking environment, it was fairly restrictive with the advice you could give. You were pretty limited to just say selling Westpac type products, or there was a wholesale fund you could sell to. But quite often the advice was pretty boring because people were coming in and going, oh, I want to invest in shares and make money out of the share market, you know, and I want to get a 10% return or 8% return or whatever the case was. But you'd sit down with them, Cole, and they'd have, you know, 45 grand worth of debt on credit cards, you know, paying 17%. It's like, well,
yep,
you know, that portion of money you want to invest, probably clear that first, because I can't guarantee you 17%, but I can guarantee you're going to pay negative 17% if you don't clear that debt, you know. So it ended up being quite basic things we were doing that way. There was, you know, some big ones. The biggest one I had was a couple of $1 million from a sale of like a Bunnings or a site to a Bunnings store back in the day, you know, a block of land, and this farmer came in, so I got $2 million. What do I do there? But yeah, it was pretty restrictive. So I'd actually gone to like a seminar myself and then started to see about buying and selling of businesses or capital raising and startups. And that sort of piqued my interest a bit at that point. And I ended up moving to Sydney and starting a like an advisory sort of business. And that's where the gold business started. That's where I first came across like the likes of Star Whiskey and all those sorts of ones. There was a tire recycling business in there, multiple sort of businesses that were sort of in there. We started probably a bit early on the green bit with some businesses that were like in recycling and things of that nature. The green plant wasn't as big back then in the early 2000s as obviously what it is now, but a few of those took a bit of a while to get up. But yeah, that's how it sort of started, going from finances and then into capital raising. You know, what amazed me is that you could start a business with nothing, give yourself shares at nil consideration, and then you're basically printing money in a way, you know, like by issuing shares then to people who'd buy into it. That was the thing that fascinated me, is that by doing startups, you're starting with nothing or minimal capital, that you put in the sweat equity, but you can start up a company with shares. And then as you issue those shares and the value comes, your shares go up in value. And that sort of really interested me, that you could do that. And you weren't restricted. You could basically come up with ideas and then have a crack. They don't all work, but when they do work, they're really good. Like, you know, you mentioned Starwood and some of the others.
There's a few things I want to unpack there. I think financial literacy is something I don't see particularly much in cybersecurity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody says boards need to have more cyber literacy, right?
Yep.
They don't understand how do we manage, you know, patching across our workforce or what is like that, or like any of that kind of stuff is things that they just don't really get a lot of the time. But by the same token, I'd say that a lot of cyber professionals aren't able to do double accounting or to talk about profit loss statements or return on investment, the credit card debt.
Yep.
That's a great example, you know?
I think we should be teaching cybersecurity in schools. You know, we teach kids to wear a seatbelt when they're young, brush your teeth. And I can hear you got some young kids in the background. You know, my girls are older, they're sort of 18 and 21, but you know, when they're young, you know, we could be really teaching them about, you know, strong passwords and, you know, or password managers and multi-factor authentication and updates when available, you know, slip, slop, slap of cyber, you know, for kids, you know, to sort of throw that in. And also, as you said, Cole, I think we should be teaching financial literacy from an early age as well. You know, the Dolomite account back in the days where you get kids just investing money into a bank was obviously a good strategy for Commonwealth Bank to pick up, you know, customers early. But what was that really teaching kids about, you know, financial literacy? So if we could sort of throw those two things in the mix early, I think that would benefit everyone because, yeah, to be able to read a P&L like a profit and loss and a balance sheet and to actually be able to work that out, you know, debits and credits, source and use of funds, just the basics of finance would be great, I think, for all of us to better control what we do and what's good debt and what's bad debt, you know. Yes, buying a house and investing in that, that's good debt, and then you buy a car or a depreciating asset or spend it on your credit card, buying clothes or whatever, bad stuff. I think it sounds very simplistic, but I just, and cyber can be in the basics as well, in our foundation, and I think finance should be similarly taught in a way where we can just get those foundational basics in place just to be able to budget and just do the basic things we need in life, especially in these, you know, tougher financial times.
I'm doing two things in, I guess, those realms at the moment. So one of which is I'm kind of working with Investment New South Wales to look at high school students and getting them to consider cybersecurity outside of the traditional, let's just don't click on links and, you know, just get away from that kind of viewpoint. And also to stop scaring people away from, you know, we build our entire discipline on people, process and technology.
Yeah.
So why do we only exclusively follow on the tech stuff and say you need to be a programmer or a network security analyst and understand how to run EdMap when what we need is diversity of thought and different types of opinions and viewpoints? And by the time people enroll at university, we've already kind of failed with creating that pipeline because we already know that, you know, computer science, software engineering is going to heavily weight towards 90% men. So like we've already lost half the population at that point. So
yeah, no, you're right. And they drop out early, don't they? Like the girls, I know a friend of mine, Kylie Watson, she said, you know, her daughters were getting into coding, but, you know, a lot of boys, so they tended to drop out, you know, by the time they got to sort of year seven. You know, Jackie Lousdale from AWSN, you know, they did a study recently, I think with RMIT, where it said that I think it's 17% women in the workforce, and you've got Untapped, another organization for neurodiversity, you know, trying to look at things. And you're right, it's a big piece where we need to grab people from other industries, maybe for governance, risk and compliance, from legal or accounting. Yeah, we've got a big gap there that we could fill, that we could get a bit more flexible with, you know, to try and bring in people and attract people. But I think one of the key things is that we need a cradle to grave approach too. So we need to start at school and make that pathway possible earlier. And as you say that there is multiple disciplines and multiple streams we can do from, you know, awareness. Like when I started with Jono and he was starting up Cyber Aware, you know, from the awareness and phishing stuff where you could have a different skill set all the way through to pen testing and, you know, red teaming and all the other things that people get excited about. But there's a big sphere in between that we can be doing as well, you know. So yeah, it's a very broad church that we're sort of narrowly focused on, unfortunately, and often looking for the same type of person or avatar of what that should look like.
We'll get there eventually, Bo. So as long as we keep putting effort into thinking about what's happening with pipeline at all levels, because we do need people who are board directors and senior leaders to get to a point where they can have meaningful conversations about cybersecurity risk, but we also need to have people not self-selecting out of careers in their pathway, whether they're mid-career and looking for something different or just beginning their university degrees, right?
Mm.
Just needs a whole society, a different approach to it. So
yeah, we're getting there, but as you say, slowly, hopefully this new 2030 strategy will make things fast track a bit more.
I'm really keen to learn more about that, but let's stick to the financial literacy piece for a bit too, because I think that that's made a big difference to my career personally, because it's meant that I've been able to have more meaningful discussions with senior leadership about like why we would invest or spend money on certain types of things. Maybe not even invest, because you don't get a return on security. It's just a waste of money, right?
That's what I say, until I get a hit.
Until I get hit, right? Maybe it's, you know, insurance. But ultimately, you can have these kind of discussions. And I didn't really learn this stuff until like I was already like, you know, been working for like 6-7 years. And I think the thing that made me really understand this stuff in great detail was actually running my own business, right?
Yep.
Because
you have to know your numbers.
You have to be able to, you know, plan cash flow. You need to understand like what the hell the difference between IaaS and BaaS is.
Yep.
Yeah. If everyone's financial literacy stops at buy ETFs because 5% return forever is great, maximize your super, and don't get credit cards, then I feel like we're all going to be worse off.
Yeah. Yeah, well, especially with inflation the way it is at the moment, what's on the horizon possibly as well. So, and that's interesting. I did a session last week with Pitcher Partners where they're sort of a consulting accounting firm, but they bought all the partners around.
So Pitcher Partners, I know that they have a building in CBD Newcastle, so I've actually heard of them before. So
yeah, they're spread around Australia. They're probably next tier down from the big accounting firms we know of. But Adam Irwin, who I've known, he was one of the initial users of Cyberware when we started. He's been a big supporter along the way. But I've got to take my hat off to those sort of organisations, you know, that are putting it there. Financial institutions, they often understand risk because, you know, they fall under a lot of rules and regulations due to, you know, being in that area with what they do. But to be as good as they are or taking the strides they are on cybersecurity is actually really good to see as well, and how seriously they take it as a group. It was good to sit on the day and just to hear the general vernacular that they're talking about with regard to cyber from going back to 2017-18, just so when I first met him, to seeing the organization and how far they've come in that time. And they've been using Cyberware the whole time, you know, and they said, you know, people are having those water cooler conversations now about cybersecurity, their staff, you know. The general vernacular in the office has changed a lot compared to when they sort of first brought it in. So you can't be using cyber or cyber training enough, I don't think. You know, they're doing at least minimum monthly training and sometimes more regular than that. Everyone who gets onboarded has 3 or 4 lessons, I think, as soon as they come on around cybersecurity, the keys of that, you know. So
yep.
It is changing, which is good. But yeah, they've got that side, the financial literacy, but it's good to see they're adding the cyber. Be nice to see, you know, the other way around. There's a lot of other areas as well.
Are you still working there, or is that still?
So, Jono and I, he's not just the best mate. We're like brothers, you know. So I'm still a smallish shareholder in the business, and obviously assist. We catch up and talk business quite regularly. He's a super smart cookie. He's actually one of the other businesses we can talk about is New Domain in there. He sold that to Melbourne IT last year, which I sort of helped him out. It was a one-man band, became a two-man band, became bought out by Melbourne IT last year. But we sort of started that, I think it was back 2014 or thereabouts, you know, that we sort of participated in that. But no, Cyberware is ticking along. I mean, the best thing we ever did with that was make it a white label solution because, you know,
yep.
When we went to the market, the big players are obviously still like no before Cofence, which I think was Fishme at the time.
Cofence, yep.
Yeah. We weren't going to be able to go head-to-head with them. There's a funny story behind that. Maybe we can leave it for another day. But KnowBefore did make an offer to us in the early days to sort of buy us out. But we really wanted to be, and the pivot we made, which was really good, was a white label solution for MSPs and MSSPs where, you know, unless you dug really deep in the DNS, you wouldn't know we're involved. But it was, they've already got the clients. It's an add-on service. They can just bolt it on. But, it, you know, it's a key sort of piece of the puzzle, you know, to have the training and the phishing sims and all that sort of stuff in there. So we can a white label solution, you know, so there's plenty of partners around the world and hundreds of thousands of people using the platform, you know, because of that. So it was a smart move to make that pivot early. But yeah, I think, you know, along with all the other pillars, training and awareness is obviously a key pillar, you know, with that to the general populace.
So because you got a lot of business experience, how have you felt that's shaped your move into cybersecurity in the end? Because I know you've done a variety of different types of roles. Because you mentioned mining before, and you've had Cyberware as well, and
yep.
You've also done a whiskey company
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
So maybe even talk about that. Why not? I love whiskey. I'm a big whiskey fan. So
yeah, well, I think I probably loved it too much, to be fair. But look, the thing is, the key with everything is business, and business has certain fundamentals that you need to do.
Yep.
And I think when picking a business or looking at it, I knew nothing about whiskey when I met Dave Vitale. So one of the first things I said is, can you teach me about whiskey? So why is this business going to work? Basically, educate me or teach me as to why this business is going to work. And he was really good at doing that. So one of the key pillars that really sold me on that one, and we sort of had a chat before we started, just really briefly about that, because I know you are interested, but one of the key things is, why is Australian whiskey going to work? And at that point, New World whiskies were just becoming a thing. Like Japan was starting to produce some really good whiskies. And where our real point of difference was, or where he sold me, was not just the numbers that he showed me over the time frame. As, yeah, in 2007, in August, when we first met, he had numbers out till 2022, you know, to say, here's what the business will do and here's why it's going to be good. So really quickly, what happens, just for people who don't know about whiskey, is that it goes into barrels to basically age. So it's a new make spirit. You basically distill off, or the steam from beer, the alcohol comes off that through the still and then goes in there, and it's your new make spirit, goes into a barrel and you lay it away. Now, everything in Scotland is basically very much a age statement. You know, it's been aged for 7 years or 14 years or 21 years, etc. But the thing is, it's cold over there, you know, so they really only get 1 month of summer at best, or warmth, you know, so the barrels don't work that hard. And what David said is, he said, and why we got some R&D funding up earlier with that was that let's research and develop if we can actually get whiskey matured quicker. So we got 50-litre barrels, 100-litre barrels, 200-litre barrels. And the barrels that we can get here are actually great too. McWilliam Sherry Cask, right, you know, which was the Solera's, the original ones, that some of them have been later, 70 years of getting filled with sherry. They're soaked with sherry, so they're really strong, you know, and that sort of thing. And McLaren Vale Reds, you know, another one.
I know both. So McGuigan's like really close to where I live in Newcastle. It's just up at the Hunter Valley, and McLaren Vale's like South Australia, I believe.
Yeah. So we had access to these barrels. So whereas what was happening with the Scotch whiskies, they'd often get something made like a bourbon cask that would come over after 2 years and send over, or it'd be something from France, you know, sort of send over the brick barrels up and send them over there. Barrels aren't working that hard. So in Melbourne, we do get four seasons in one day. So where we set up, you get a hot day like today, it was 22, not hot for Melbourne, hot, right? Yep. 22. But tomorrow's going to be like 12. So what happens is the barrels expand with the heat. And then what we do is open up the roller doors when the wind changes. So the barrels are actually making more contact, and you make spirit-based contact. We were getting 50-litre barrels maturing within 9 months. The bigger barrels will take longer, obviously the hundreds and 200s, but within 3 or 4 years you can get, I mean, you've seen the awards we've won. You know, we've been winning. Last year we won 15 double gold medals, which means every judge judged each one of those 15 bottles the best in class. We were number one distillery out of 5,000 in the world last year. This year another 12 double gold and then 3 gold, you know, so the quality of whiskey we've been able to produce is not any worse from being shorter. It's actually better. And that's why Diageo bought. Diageo was starting to use, and Diageo make Johnny Walker and all that sort of stuff, in some cases having to add caramel color to their whiskey to give it color. You know, they were really struggling to keep up supply demand. It was growing 30% year on year. They couldn't keep up with the demand, and they weren't producing quick enough. So that's why they bought in 2015 to see that, you know, this was a way of actually making whiskey or doing it differently. The Taiwanese do it as well. I think they've got, what was one of my favorite ones? I've sort of not been drinking as much whiskey as I used to, but there's a whiskey brand in Taiwan that their angel share, the evaporation is about 13%. Ours was about 9% or something like that. And in Scotland, you might lose 3%, you know, to angel share, which is the evaporation up there. But it's what you're producing and maximizing from getting it out of the barrel quicker, which was the key part there. So that was the key to it. Once David explained it to me, showed me through different whiskeys, you know, with smoky flavors and all different things. Having Bill Lark there, who's like the godfather of Australian whiskey. Chris Middleton, who's like the brand guy, Australian guy behind Jack Daniels. You know, Jack lives here and all that sort of stuff. When you've got a good team together with absolute supreme knowledge, and then you can justify a business case for it, then you've got a story. Why Starwood whiskey? You know, why we call it New World whiskey, you know, and that's why it has the sort of stars and looking as New Explorers did. Once you put all those elements together, it seems like a goer. Sometimes even with all those things together, it might not work, but we were lucky to get into Dan Murphy's fairly early, you know, obviously with the Woolworths Group and things like that. They were looking to make new shelf space at the time. So, I mean, you create your own luck as well. We had, you know, I think timing was good. It wasn't great that GFC hit the year after we started trying to raise capital. That made things difficult. We had to pre-sell barrels and do barrel sale program, which you would have loved, Cole, if you're back in the day. It's like, give us some money to buy a barrel, right? And we'll pay you 10% on top of the barrel when it matures. And so you can make 10% on your money, right? And if we go bust, you get to keep the barrel of whiskey and we'll even bottle it for you. You know, there was that was our promise, you know, if it all went the wrong way, you know, you're actually going to get a bottle. So we had a lot of, obviously, whiskey enthusiasts that are like, I'm into that deal. I either get 10% of my money or I get a big barrel of whiskey, you know, so it's a win-win, you know, so that was, that's how it sort of all started.
That's such a fascinating story. What you've basically done is looked at what the problems of traditional whiskey is, which is the maturation, you know, 12, 15, 20 years, right? And then you've said, okay, how do we short circuit this so that we can produce significantly more volume? And then we're going to change the category so that value isn't, the value of the whiskey isn't derived purely on the time associated with its maturation. It's based on the flavors and the quality of the casks and stuff, right?
Yeah.
So you've effectively established a new type of category and the marketing around it as well. Like, you know, good timing is really important with business. It's something that I'm hoping to ride myself within application security.
Yeah.
Because if you're looking like in Australia, like I'm doing things, I'm looking at what people do with professional services firms and saying, well, what's not working, what is working? And almost everybody here bills like time and materials, day rate consulting, or fixed price for a product. And almost nobody services application security, right? And with my branding, nobody is fun and approachable and clear and simple, right? Everyone's men's deodorant commercials. So I've been thinking about like category design when I've been doing my own business. So it's good to hear that that's how you've been successful with Starwood, because that's kind of what I'm hoping to replicate, at least myself with Galah.
Yeah, and that's, you got to look at things differently. And as I say, it doesn't mean that it always will work. You know, we, with that gold business, it was really a gold site remediation type technology. So the theory was there that a lot of gold mining companies were using large gravity feeds with, you know, a lot of chemicals to basically extract the gold. We were going back in there with shaker tables to clean out some of the fines of gold, like the smaller bits, but also clean out some of the chemicals of bauxite, you know, and get stuff out of the mines to clean them up. So you could do a JV with the mine owners who had basically stopped mining there. You could get the stuff which was left behind, which wasn't the chunks, but the finer of gold, and also clean up the soil and the waterways and everything around a mine as well. So it was sort of like a sort of a win-win-win around there. So that one wasn't as successful, and that's why I did a post yesterday, because it was 12 years to the day since we raised the 11 mil, the 51 mil market cap. We didn't list it on September 19, but we took a lot of investment. We only got 900,000 of the 11.9 or whatever it was million here in Australia from brokers. It was really hard to raise money here, but we could raise money easily in Asia. And there was one Chinese investor who put in majority of the money. We thought it was 18-odd%. He had actually been buying through other entities, so he actually had majority share and basically overthrew us within 3 weeks after the company listed. Came in there and said, here, sign this and off you go, which was the first kick in the pants, you know, from business. And then I was escrowed for 2 years, which means I couldn't sell the shares, and I just watched the shares just plummet down. So by the time I'd sort of got out, they dropped, you know, like 90% or 90+%. So they were virtually useless and worthless, you know, after that time. So it was, that was a bit of a kick in the guts from 2003, get to listing in 2011, get through the GFC and all those sorts of things. And then to have that sort of happen at the final stretch was a bit of a kick in the pants and did flatten me for a while. But there's the yin and yang of business. 15 years being overnight success, and this one here, you know, you graft away for sort of 8 years or 9 years to get it listed, and then, you know, end up with nothing at the end of the day. So there's, yeah, I think we need to talk about the mistakes, and that's what I think we need to do in cyber as well, is that we need to see these incidents and say, rather than pulling the shutters down and covering up what's actually happened, let's share some of the lessons learned from actually the mistakes that are made. I mean, there's been some high profile ones that, you know, across the press, we know a bit about what's happened with them, but it'd be good to actually say, what do we learn from the mistakes? Because you learn way more from your mistakes than you do from your successes. You know, when you have success, you can go on a golden streak, and we've all had those, you know, we go on a run where everything seems to be turning to gold, but it's from the times where you actually have those tough times. I would have likened it to maybe losing one of my children or something like that, having that business collapse the way it did on me. You know, I was flat, you know, even though I had sort of Starwood to go to and sort of do some stuff with. That wasn't easy. That was going through a difficult time as well. You know, put stress personally on me with, you know, your relationships and stuff like that as well. So I think we need to talk about this sort of stuff, and same in cyber. You know, we have these incidents. Ideally, it'd be good to unpick it like we do with a bushfire or a, you know, a natural disaster. We go back through and say, well, could we have trimmed the grass around the power lines more or trimmed the branches back? It'd be nice to be able to do that with a lot of these cyber attacks, not just the big high-profile ones, but all of them, to say, let's unpack them and actually see what happens so we can all learn from it, which doesn't tend to happen, unfortunately, and that's something I think would be ideal to see.
Yeah, I'd really like to see more people who are honest about where they make mistakes. I try to be pretty open about what I make mistakes with my business, because I know that I would encourage many people to go and actually take a step to create a cybersecurity company.
Yeah.
Now, you could start off really small and just be a consultancy and just solve, you know, one particular problem that you're really good at.
Yeah.
But over time, eventually, you'll want to expand it, and that creates opportunities for other people who may not have those opportunities to come in and learn from you and your experience. And if you make mistakes, then you can go ahead and teach other people about those as well. For me, it's pretty table stakes, right? If I am open about how I make mistakes, then people are, what's he know, right? But it would be good to see the bigger businesses recognizing that, yeah, you know, like with Optus is a great example, is last week they refused to release the Deloitte report about how they got breached, right?
Yep.
And I know that Kelly has gone and individually spoken to a lot of different CISOs around Australia about what's happened and all the events leading up to it. But it would be really good to be able to talk about that report and what we can do to make Australia the most cyber resilient by 2030. If that's where the government wants to go to, we have to be transparent about this, right?
Yeah, well, and I think that'll be the interesting thing off the back of this. Let's see what happens. But that's the ultimate outcome, isn't it? If we can get to the point where that is the case, that would be ideal. But the thing is that as a defender, you could stop a million attacks and you're wrong once and you're sort of hung, drawn and quartered for it. Whereas, you know, the attacker only needs to be right once and can do a million attempts, you know. So both sides of the equation, you know, we're lauded for a successful attack as a cyber criminal. They're like, well done, you know, you had a million pots and you finally got one to pop, and that's worth it for them. They can make some decent coin out of it. But on the other side, someone's got something right for 20 years of their career, makes one mistake and they're sort of often hung, drawn and quartered and you're out, you made a mistake. You know, and that's not a good position to put people in either. It's a stressful enough job as it is without having that as your ultimate outcome from a mistake. There's so many things that go into cybersecurity, and it can just be an API, it could be something that could have been missed, and especially in the size teams that some of these companies have, it's easy for stuff to slip through the cracks, you know. So what happened? Let's learn from it, and so everyone else can fix those same or similar problems or think about their own situation a bit better.
One of the things that I see a lot in software engineering, or more specifically site reliability engineering, is blameless postmortems.
Yeah.
So the idea is that a website service goes offline. What are we going to do about it to make sure that that doesn't happen again, right? And there's no one to blame, because ultimately we made a bunch of decisions that led us to this point in time where the website went offline.
Yeah.
And because as soon as we start attributing blame to individual people or teams or like whatever, then we're attacking individuals and not attacking the root cause behind why it happened. I'd love to see more of that kind of behavior from companies. I'd also love to see if people are more open and transparent about it.
Yeah.
Even if it's something as simple as, like, let's say you have a bunch of cyber incidents, and then the next year, when those cyber incidents fade into obscurity and no longer relevant, you go out and talk about what you've meaningfully done to actually, like, what happened, what the consequences were, and then what you've meaningfully done to actually move forward since then.
Yeah.
I'd love to see more businesses talking about that.
Mm. Yeah. Let's see what happens. There is some shifting of the sands and some movement in the market, but that's it'd be a nice panacea to get to, but we do need to have that, I think, just generally across the market to help us all out, yeah, you know, realistically. So let's stay tuned and hopefully we see something happen.
That's right. So going into your more recent career, because you were at Lost Cyber not too long ago, correct?
Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of money. Ossob was set up back in Malcolm Turnbull's days, back in 2017. So as part of the growth network.
Yep.
So it was one of the last ones left, and it did do a merger with Stone and Chalk about 2 years ago, a bit over 2 years ago. So yeah, there's still it's basically come to the end of its natural life. I think the mainly funded by Dicer, and it basically we got an extension of time but not money. So everything was supposed to end June 30 this year, and just to finish off the project, sort of going till sort of June 30 next year. So they'll just be sort of wrapping up the last little bits of some of the projects. One of the ones that was quite successful was the start of the professionalization scheme. So we talked about the education piece, and it's trying to set up, and I think only Australia really and the UK are the ones trying to crack that nut at the moment. You know when you go and get a qualified builder or an electrician or what have you, but we don't really have that, the cybersecurity. There's people out there saying, yeah, I'm a cybersecurity specialist, or I specialize in these things, but what's the certification for it? So it was good to have around the table, you know, all the academic people here. ISACA, ICS Squared, you know, ACS, you know, AAA, etc., to work this together, because if we can get a collaboration on that call and then get a sign-off on that to have some sort of agreement with the varying avatars across different areas, you know, not making an extra cost for anyone, so it'll be it's not going to be set up for profit, but basically there'll be a cost obviously to run that sort of organisation, but, you know, members of certain other organisations will get discounts, there'll be grandfathering clauses for people with pre-existing skills, etc., you know, so that was a really positive piece of work that we had, and getting that collaboration and people. Yeah, you know, it did start off a bit testy. I remember, you know, some of the original meetings with people being strong personalities in there and all sort of protecting their own turf and saying, you know, we are better or what we do is best and all that sort of stuff. But it got to a point of general consensus. So I think off the back of the cyber strategy, that piece of work will continue on, you know, to get and find what a cyber professional will look like as a scheme. As I say, UK are doing a lot of work on that front as well. You know, DSCP was always a good piece of work. The Sector Competitiveness Plan, it was always sort of a Bible for people to go to in cyber to look at for, you know, the latest stats, you know, so to see what's happening in the market, where we might have gaps with employment and other stats with startups and all those sorts of things as well. you know, Cyber Week was really good, opened by Minister O'Neill last year, where we launched the SDP and everything. So yeah, there's a lot of good work that's come out of AusCyber over the time, and I think a lot of it will continue on in whatever shape or form that takes, you know, sort of going forward. But yeah, I think the industry has matured a lot over that time. If you look at when AusCyber started and the work that Michelle Price and the team did to get it kicked off, that was a very, very small market at the time. We sort of lost ThyRise as well over, you know, the last sort of few months. So I just think it's a change in the guard, and this new cyber strategy hopefully, you know, draws that sort of line in the sand, and it's something that we can sort of progress forward from as a more mature and collaborative piece of work and industry, you know, sort of going forward rather than being so segmented and pulling in multiple different directions as we often have.
Yeah, the professionalization is, I've seen so many people argue in both directions, right? I know that offensive security is really wedded to Crest.
Yep.
As like the, like, I guess domestic, or I guess international standard for...
Yeah, well, there's different Crests, isn't there?
Yeah, there's multiple Crests anyway. So, and
yeah,
like the other things is, any layman, like just purchaser, is not going to really understand the difference between a CISP, a CISM, a CISA, an IRAP, a ISO 27001 lead implementer, or whatever.
Yep.
Like, I guess so it makes sense to move towards having a standard that they can actually understand. But my problem, I guess, with it is that I don't want there to create, when we need a lot of different diverse viewpoints and talent, if we create like a professionalization to actually get into the industry, are we just like creating barriers to entry and gatekeeping? And that's something that worries me a bit. And the other thing as well is, it's difficult to get people to learn about something if their salary depends on them not knowing it, right?
Yeah.
So getting these certification providers to all agree to a national accreditation body would directly cut into their ability to sell CISPs and CISMs and CISAs and so on, right? So I don't know.
I don't think it will limit it. I think it's how it's going to be seen. So a couple of points there. I think if you're a kid and you're trying to go for a career, like if I had to sit down with my year nine coordinator at the moment and say I want to go and be a plumber, or I want to do accounting, or I want to do something, there's a fairly clear pathway.
Yeah.
One of the things is to open that pathway up, but it's not to cannibalize any of those sorts of things. It's say, if you go for this, this is what that qualification will get you. So this is what, if you want to do this role, here's the suggested. So it won't be taking anything away from any of them. It'll just basically say, here's what you qualify. I would imagine when it does get up that it wouldn't be too dissimilar in, you know, when you do gaming, just say you're playing a sports game, might be soccer or something like that. You know, it's a striker who has, you know, 76 rating and here's their speed and all that sort of stuff.
Yep.
Not too dissimilar to that, you know, saying this person is a mid-level GRC person with financial services background skills. So that could be good for the role. Or they've worked in financial services and they've also worked in retail environments or whatever. So you could sort of see what you're getting, and then they're saying they're keen to upskill or do other training or whatever, or they've learnt this on the last job so their skill can go up, you know. So I think it's more to give a clear pathway for the professional themselves, what they should be looking at or doing next. If they want to get to a certain place and if they want to go for a role, here's a pathway and where you go. So it wouldn't limit or say that you should go for ISARC or ICS² or whatever the case may be. It's just saying that these are the qualifications that will actually get you next level or go work at this next organization. We all know ourselves, you know, if you want to get better, you have to keep pushing yourself or stretching yourself to go to different areas. Or, and like I've done with my career, you sometimes pivot and take a different direction to get somewhere. But yeah, sometimes you've got to get out of the comfort zone to do that. But some people are just happy to sitting in a, and they might say, I just want to be a mid-level GRC person who works in financial services. That's my lot. I don't want to stretch any further than that, and that they'll just stay there. But at least you'll know that's what you're getting. But you can get someone who's aspirational and say, oh, I actually want to get to being a CISO one day, so what's my career pathway look like to get there?
Oh, those people need a reality check.
They do, yeah. They do. Well, you talk to any CISO, they're usually a little bit nuts, but they'll probably get a different talking to from a lot of the CISOs we know. But we just need to support that too, because I think CISOs don't, especially in this country, have as much support. They're very good amongst themselves. You mentioned about Kelly going out and speaking to CISOs, but they do have a community themselves, but it's a lonely job in a lot of ways. And as we said before, you know, if there are incidents that happen, they tend to be the one the board point the finger at and everyone else does to take the bullet. Yeah, it's something I think as a whole community we need to be supportive of in whatever shape that takes. And the next stage will be into more open up to the public. Here's the what's it all, here's the FAQ sort of all answered. So we can get that feedback from industry and have it nutted out. You know, as I said, I still think it's probably realistically probably 2026-ish type, you know, sort of time frame until something like it comes out. It's got a lot of more barriers, but it was good to get that starting point, actually start to get something knocked into shape.
Yeah, and we've got to do these kind of things to be ready for 2030 anyway, so.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things that you did mention, though, is that it's lonely at the top. And, you know, I really empathize with that. I don't consider myself a CISO because obviously, I don't know, I've got more brown hair than gray at the moment. So but we'll see how that goes. But I run my own business, though. And one of the things with running my own business is that, for better or worse, I don't really have other people I can speak to unless they're other business owners, right?
No.
To talk about the challenges I go through with things as simple as like hiring people or cash flow management, forecasting, sales strategies, to how to do effective consulting, good customers and bad customers. Ultimately, everything like falls onto my head as a chief executive of my own company, right?
Yeah.
So I empathize and I understand what it's like to be a CISO in some ways because all the responsibility for security falls on their heads and it's lonely up there.
Yeah, you need good people in your support network. Yeah, I sort of spoke about Jono when we did Cyberware, you know, that you need someone else that you sort of do need the yin and yang in your business sometimes. You know, sometimes people start businesses and if they do have other people, it's two similar people. I think one of the best things advice-wise, if you're ever growing a team, is to have people who fill the gaps and stuff you're not great at. You do what you're good at and the stuff that you know needs to be done in business but is not your one wood, get other people who that's what they specialize in, you know, if you really start to grow a business often. One of the things I do see with a lot of startups is they get two people who are both coders and they're both great at a certain thing, but that's never going to get you anywhere in business. And I think, you know, some good examples that we have in Australia is like, to say, Sidearm, you know, with Vaughn and Ben, you know, they've got two different sort of skill sets and then you can grow a team around that, having the varying sort of personality types. But Vaughn, when he started, he was trying to do so many things and be so many things that he just couldn't do. And as soon as Ben came on and sort of took some of the load off for some of the stuff that he wasn't great at, it got the business sort of moving forward a bit better. So I think, you know, for any business, for yourself or anyone else, you need to, you know, when you're expanding your business, you need to look for people who have the requisite skills where they love doing the stuff you don't and vice versa, you know, and you can have some crossover and some convergence and some things, but, you know, generally speaking, if you can try and get people that love doing stuff you don't, and you concentrate and stick to what you're really good at is actually really helpful. But yeah, any business, it's good to have jack of all trades, master of none. A lot of things, you do need to know financials, you need to know a lot of things because yeah, you've got to make sure you've got yourself covered and control as much as you can when you start, but then you need to start getting comfortable handing stuff over to people you trust as well.
I've got a few fast questions for you and then we'll wrap up. So here we go. All right, first thing to come to your head for these ones.
Okay.
Best book to give someone?
Oh, best book. Wow. I've read so many books and I have to go. I've actually been reading some stuff on longevity stuff at the moment.
Okay.
Outlived by Peter Attia, I just read recently, which was a surprising book. It was really slow to start, had some really good information in the middle, and then had a surprising sort of ending. So that was one that I read recently, which was really good. But yeah, my books, I'm usually going and flowing through a lot at once. So yeah, I could probably give you a different recommendation every day. I'm just trying to think. Atomic Habits, James Clear was another one that was good recently. And actually Happy by Derren Brown was really good. Derren, D-E-R-R-E-N Brown. Happy by title, but yeah, it was interesting, more stoic sort of principles on that one.
I think I've done two of those. So I've done, definitely remember Atomic Habits.
Yep.
And I think GTD was pretty similar to it in a lot of ways. Atomic Habits, just kind of recognize your triggers and then like,
yep,
if you don't know what's causing you to do these kind of things, then it's really difficult to change something, right?
Yep.
So for me, a good example would be I see chocolate wafers in the cupboard and then I go and eat the chocolate wafers.
I put them there.
So the chocolate wafers now are in a really stupid location. And guess what? The habit's broken. I don't eat chocolate wafers anymore.
Yeah. So. Talk about the lock and key. Cadbury's chocolate for me is my Achilles heel. It was Father's Day Sunday. My daughter bought for me like three blocks of Cadbury's chocolate. I think it lasted no more than 48 hours for all three blocks. So that's a killer for me.
I'm the worst with the chocolate too. So like it's Turkish, the Fry's Turkish Delights, my like yep. kind of crypto.
Which are Cadbury's now.
Yeah, I know, Cadbury's, right?
So yeah. Dangerous.
And the longevity one, I think I remember Daniel Meisler talking about it a bit. He was saying it basically rolled down to two things that he saw, I think, was just actually do exercise, which I need to learn.
Yep.
And sleep, I think, was the other big one.
Yep. It's two keys, yeah. And I think it's a similar theme at the moment, Cole. I think sleep is massive, and I have stopped drinking this year, so it's funny, like we're talking about whiskey and stuff, but at the start of the year I'd made a pact with myself. I said I'll just drink once a month, like if it's a friend's birthday or a special occasion, I'll just have something, which I did do January, February, and then I just thought no one really cares if I'm drinking or not, so I'll just stop. So yeah, I just haven't had a drop since then, and that's really improved my sleep massively. And during COVID, the first part of COVID when it happened in Melbourne, I ate and drank way too much. And then on the second part, I bought myself a home gym set up. And then I've been working out sort of religiously, sort of, you know, 5 or 6 times a week, you know, and then walking that sort of at least 12,000 steps a day. But they do make a big difference. So yeah, it had been something, I think the Andrew Huberman podcast got me into Tim Ferriss. I've been listening to for years. Yeah, they'd all sort of gone down that path. So I think I sort of followed them down there sort of with interest. So that's been one of the things. I think, yeah, health, if you don't have it, you can't do anything.
I think, like, I know that it's a few things that, with the whiskey, like, you know, I've got a bunch of bottles of whiskey and I like drinking it, but like I pretty much limit myself to like one glass a week, really, at a time where it actually makes sense, because like I just don't need to be drinking. I've swapped all my soft drink for Soda-Li.
Yep.
Nowadays, which it's made of apple cider vinegar.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. Mm.
I've been on the kombucha.
Just simple stuff like that can make life a lot easier, and you can still enjoy like a, you know, a bit of a dark habit. Maybe we need to do less on the Turkish delight and the caramel.
Yeah, that's probably it.
You know, we'll take that over alcohol.
Occasionally it's okay. Yeah.
Cool. Let's move on to the next quick one. A best advice for someone who's going to start a cybersecurity business.
Yeah, I think if you're starting a business, most people obviously coming out with a cyber background in some way, shape or form. I think what we need to do is look to solve for problems into the future rather than trying to compete or try and make something better than what's already existing. Yeah, with the likes of AI and quantum, you know, pretty much all generative AI here, but into the future with quantum and different things happening, we need to, I think in Australia, look to solve for problems into the future. Often we've been a bit of a lag behind because we're often just saying, oh, someone else has got a product in the market, I can make it better than they do, you know, and then we're all just undercut on price. I think we need to really look into the future and say, what is the future of cybersecurity and what do we need to solve for in tomorrow's problems, and start to look at there. I think the other thing we can do too, if I was going to start a business, I'd be really talking to the CISOs of the world and say, what are the top 5 things you need to solve for? Because when you then go to them with the solution that's in that top 5, they're going to have budget for it and they're going to give you a POC or try and help, and they'll mentor you and probably co-invest with you and do a whole lot of things if we can actually sort of flip there. So find out what the actual problems are, what they perceive problems to be that could be coming out visual. I wish I had this. And if you get enough of that, that's usually a good clue. So don't try and make something and then sell it to market. I'd go the other way around and say, what's the actual market want? Can I build that? And let's go and do that.
I like both of those. You know, I see so many people just start their own little consultancies up, and it's like, yeah, all well and good. You can be a pen tester. I personally think that penetration testing is part of quality assurance, and that over time, as we get better quality assurance products in the software engineering market, or that more people just use, you know, software-defined networks or like infrastructure as code and so on, we're going to have less of a need for network security penetration testing, but we're going to probably have more of a need for software engineering chops.
Yeah.
And so I've positioned myself to be super aligned with software engineering and application security, because I guess domestically, I don't see anyone really servicing this industry at all. It's pretty much, it's huge in the US,
yeah,
and it's huge in Europe, and I don't know why it doesn't exist here.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm in that category, in a place that no one else is participating in yet. So I encourage people, if you've got an interest in, you know, large language models or blockchain or whatever, and you can find product market fit by speaking to customers and getting just one or two people on board, then maybe go do that if you're doing it right.
Yeah, exactly. And the lead from overseas is key too. I mean, we're such a small market, 2.3% of the world cyber market. Go and look at what Israel do. You know, if you want to do a startup, 30% of billion-dollar companies or unicorn companies are out of Israel. 10 million, not even 10 million head of population, you know, producing that sort of output. But why is that? And then you got to look at the clues and then sort of follow through, you know, and see why certain markets do certain things well, and take the good of that and strip away any of the negative stuff. People try and always look for the negative in things all the time rather than going, okay, what's working and how can we replicate that? Rather than just trying to pick the eyeballs out of it and find mistakes all the time.
And I think the other thing is to be a bit more open-minded as well. If you are a CISO or a leader, about speaking to people from Australia.
Yep.
You don't have to go buy the Forrester Wave top quadrant Gartner thing all the time. Mm. There's a lot of good local producers that solve specific problems, and supporting local industry is a really good idea. We may not be the most competitive at the moment compared to, you know, if you go to Singapore or Vietnam or India.
Yeah.
But I still think it's good to at least hear people out. Like, I always get frustrated when I see CISOs on LinkedIn whinging that salespeople should never contact them at any point and that they know what they want to buy at all points in time. And
yeah,
I just think that that's like entitled and a bit of a cop out. So
yeah. Yeah. To be fair, and putting yourself in their shoes, a lot of them do get hit a lot. So they get peppered. And often, you know, from knowing a lot of CISOs, I think their team's better to approach about stuff that they'll make a decision on and can go to the CISO a bit easier. So I think if you are a startup and, you know, been through the mill, not just with cybersecurity, but with others, is find out the key person or the key buyer in a business or the key person that solution is going to fix. So rather than go to the CISO, who's sort of, you know, overarching looking at stuff, but go down the chain a bit and say, who in the business would benefit most from this, and actually have a talk to them and get that feedback in there. So I think what people do often, Cole, is they'll go on LinkedIn and say, oh, there's a CISO, I'll go talk to them. They really need this product because he heads that company or she heads that company. Whereas sometimes you're better off saying, who actually works in that specific area for that cyber team that would actually get the most benefit from it, and let me see if I can help them or make their job easier and then get them to sell themselves to, or that product or service to, the actual CISO themselves.
All right, guys, got it. Don't go straight to the top. It doesn't work. Don't go all the way to the top.
No, look, especially if you've got big teams, I just know that, and I know when we went to RSA this year over in the US, some of them are getting, and I'm not kidding you, you know, 40 emails of people just peppering them with stuff, and this is the next best thing, and silver bullet stuff, and all that sort of thing. And to work through it when you've got your normal work to do, it's just white noise for them. So, and they do suggest that themselves. They say, you know, like, just go and find someone in my team. Like, just do a bit of homework, read our reports, or do just a little bit of stuff to say, hey, I read your last report and I saw that this was an issue for you guys. Who in your team would be best to contact and find that out? Go contact them in LinkedIn and say, I didn't want to talk to you. So I thought this was best to run past you because you obviously are at the coalface with this sort of thing. What can we do to, you know, maybe help you? This is something as a solution or some help. They don't get as much in their inbox, so they're more likely to give you an ear, make some time with you because they're not as busy, or that is something you want. So tailor it really to the specific person in the organization, I think would make a difference. So that I think it makes it easy for everyone.
There you go, guys. Some great sales advice from Jason Morrell.
There you go.
Jason, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate your time here, mate.
No worries, mate. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Secured. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Don't forget to follow the podcast on your favorite platform and leave us a review. Want some more content like the above? Why not subscribe to our newsletter at galahcyber.com.au/newsletter and get high quality AppSec content straight to your mailbox. Stay safe, stay secure, and we'll see you next episode.
If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage. And I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galahcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.